today, and now they dare come to me and tell me what Duke Richard requires of me. Elizabeth stands behind me, and my other four daughters in a row. None of my sons or brothers are present. They don't remark that my son Thomas Grey has escaped from sanctuary and is on the loose in London, and I certainly don't draw attention to his absence. They tell me that they have proclaimed Duke Richard protector of the realm, regent, and governor of the prince, and they assure me that they are preparing for the coronation of my son Prince Edward. They want my younger son, Richard, to join his brother in the royal rooms in the tower. The Duke will be protector for only a matter of days, only till the coronation, Thomas Boucher explains to me, his face so earnest that I must trust him. This is a man who has spent his life trying to bring peace to this country. He crowned Edward as king and me as queen because he believed that we would bring peace to this country. I know that he is speaking from his heart. As soon as the young king is crowned, then all the power reverts to him, and you are Dowager Queen and mother of the king, he says. Come back to your palace, your grace, and attend the coronation of your son. The people wonder that they don't see you, and it looks odd to the foreign ambassadors. Let us do as we all swore to the king on his deathbed. Put your son on the throne, and all work together, leaving aside enmity. Let the royal family be housed in the royal apartments in the tower, and let them come out in their power and their beauty for their boy's coronation. For a moment, I am persuaded. More, I am tempted. Perhaps everything can end happily. Then I think of my brother Anthony, and my son Richard Grey imprisoned together in Pontefract Castle. And I hesitate. I have to pause and think. I have to keep them safe. While I am in sanctuary, my safety and my son Richard's safety balances their imprisonment like the weights in a pair of scales. They are hostages for my good behavior, but equally, Duke Richard dare not touch them for fear of enraging me. If Richard wants to rid himself of Rivers's, he has to have all of us in his power. By keeping out of his reach, I protect those of us he does have, as well as those who are free. I have to keep my brother Anthony safe against his enemies. I have to. This is my crusade, like the one I would not let him ride. I have to keep him safe to be the light in the world that he is. I cannot release Prince Richard to you, I say, my voice filled with false regret. He has been so ill lately. I cannot bear anyone should care for him but me. He is not yet well. He has lost his voice, and if he were to have a relapse, it could be worse than his first illness. If you want him and his brother to be together, then send Edward to join us here, where I can care for them both and know that they are not in danger. I long to see my oldest son by King Edward, and know that he is safe. I pray you, send him to me, to safety. He can be crowned from here as well as from the tower. Why, madam, says Thomas Howard, bristling like the bully that he is, can you name any reason why they should be in danger? I look at him for a moment. Does he really think that he is likely to trap me into confessing my enmity to the Duke Richard? All the rest of my family are either run away or imprisoned, I say flatly. Why should I think that I and my sons are secure? Now, now, the cardinal interrupts, nodding at Howard to silence him. Anyone in prison will be tried before a court of their peers, as they should be, and the truth of any accusation will be proved or denied. The lords have ruled that no charge of treason can be brought against your brother, Anthony, Earl Rivers. That should satisfy you that we come in good faith. You cannot imagine that I myself, should come to you in anything other than good faith? Ah, my Lord Cardinal, I say, I don't doubt you. Then trust me when I give you my word, my personal word, that your boy will be safe with me. He says, I shall take him to his brother, and no harm will come to either of them. You distrust the Duke Richard, and he suspects you. This is a sorrow to me, but you both have your reasons. But I will swear that neither the Duke nor any other will harm your boys, and they will be safe together, and Edward will be crowned king. I sigh, as if I am overwhelmed by his logic. And if I refuse? He draws close to me and speaks low. I fear that he will break sanctuary and take you and all your family out of here, he says, very quietly. And all the lords think he would be right to do so. No one defends your right to be in here, Your Grace. This is a shell around you, not a castle. Let the little Prince Richard out, and they will leave you here, if that is your wish. Keep him here, and you will all be pulled out like leeches from a glass jar. Or they can smash the jar. Elizabeth, who has been looking out of the window, leans forward and whispers, Lady Mother, there are hundreds of Duke Richard's barges on the river. We are surrounded. For a moment, I do not see the Cardinal's worried face. I do not see the hard expression of Thomas Howard. I do not see the half-dozen men who have come with him. I see my husband, going into the sanctuary at Tewkesbury with his sword drawn, and I know that from that moment, sanctuary was no longer safe. Edward destroyed his son's safety that day, and he never knew. But I know it now, and thank God I have prepared for it. I put my handkerchief to my eyes. Forgive a woman's weakness, I say. I cannot bear to part with him. Can I be spared this? The Cardinal pats my hand. He has to come with us. I am sorry. I turn to Elizabeth, and I whisper, Fetch him. Fetch my little boy. Elizabeth leaves in silence, her head bowed. He has not been well, I say to the Cardinal. You must keep him wrapped up warm. Trust me, he says. He will come to no harm in my care. Elizabeth comes back with the changeling page boy. He is in my Richard's clothes, a scarf tied round his throat, muffling the lower part of his face. When I hold him to me, he even smells of my own boy. I kiss his fair hair. His little boy frame is delicate in my arms, and yet he holds himself bravely, as a prince should do. Elizabeth has taught him well. Go with God, my son, I say to him. I shall see you again at your brother's coronation in a few days. Yes, Lady Mother, he says, like a little parrot. His voice is scarcely more than a whisper, but audible to them all. I take him by the hand, and I lead him to the Cardinal. He has seen Richard at court, at a distance, and this boy is hidden by the jewelled cap on his head and the flannel round his throat and his jaw. Here is my son, I say, my voice trembling with emotion. I resign him into your hands. I do here deliver him and his brother into your safe keeping. I turn to the boy and say to him, Farewell, mine own sweet son. The Almighty be your protector. He turns his little face to me, all wrapped in the concealing scarf, and for a moment I feel a sweep of real emotion as I kiss his warm cheek. I may be sending this child into danger instead of my own, but he is still a child, and it is still danger. There are tears in my eyes when I put his little hand in the big soft palm of Cardinal Balcher, and I say to him, over the little head, Guard this boy. My boy, please, my lord, keep this boy safe. We wait as they take the boy and file from the room. When they are gone, the scent of their clothes lingers. It is the smell of the outdoors, horse sweat, cooked meats, a fresh breeze blowing over cut grass. Elizabeth turns to me, and her face is pale. You sent the page boy, for you think it is not safe for our boy to go to the tower, she observes. Yes, I say. So you must think that our Edward is not safe in the tower. I don't know. Yes, that is my fear. She takes an abrupt step to the window, and for a moment she reminds me of my mother, her grandmother. She has the same determination. I can see her puzzling away at the best course. For the first time, I think that Elizabeth will make a woman to be reckoned with. She is not a little girl anymore. I think you should send to my uncle and ask him for an agreement, she says. You could agree that we give him the throne and he names Edward as his heir. I shake my head. You could, she says. He is Edward's uncle, a man of honor. He must want a way out of this as much as we do. I will not give up Edward's throne, I say tightly. If Duke Richard wants it, he will have to take it and shame himself. And what if he does that? She asks me. What happens to Edward then? What happens to my sisters? What happens to me? I don't know, I say cautiously. We may have to fight. We may have to argue. But we don't give up. We don't surrender. And that little boy, she says, nodding to the door where the page boy has gone, his jaw tied up with flannel so he does not speak. Did we take him from his father, and bathe him and clothe him and tell him to be silent as we sent him to his death? Is that how we fight this war, using a child as our shield, sending a little boy to his death? Sunday, June 25th, 1483. Coronation Day. What? I spit at the quiet dawn sky like an angry cat whose kittens have been taken away for drowning. No royal barges, no booming cannon from the tower, no wine flowing in the fountains of the city, no banging of drums, no prentice boys howling out the songs of their guilds, no music, no shouting, no cheering along the procession route. I swing open the window that looks over the river and see the usual river traffic of barges and wherries and rowing boats, and I say to my mother and to Melusina, clearly they don't crown him today. Is he to die instead? I think of my boy as if I were painting his portrait. I think of the straight line of his little nose still rounded at the tip like a baby, and the plump roundness of his cheeks, and the clear innocence of his eyes. I think of the curve of the back of his head that used to fit my hand when I touched him, and the straight, pure line of the nape of his neck when he was bent over his books in study. He was a brave boy, a boy who had been coached by his Uncle Anthony to vault into a saddle and ride at the joust. Anthony promised him that he would be fearless by learning to face fear. And he was a boy who loved the country. He liked Ludlow Castle, for he could ride into the hills and see the peregrine falcons soaring high above the cliffs, and he could swim in the cold water of the river. Anthony said he had a sense of landscape, rare in the young. He was a boy with the most golden future. He was born in wartime to be a child of peace. He would have been, I don't doubt, a great Plantagenet king, and his father and I would have been proud of him. I speak of him as if he is dead, for I have little doubt that since he is not crowned today, he will be killed in secret, just as William Hastings was dragged out and beheaded on Tower Green on a balk of wood, with the axeman hurriedly wiping his hands from his breakfast. Dear God! When I think of the nape of the neck of my boy, and I think of the headsman's axe, I feel sick enough to die myself. I don't stay at the window watching the river that keeps flowing indifferently, as if my boy were not in danger of his life. I dress and pin up my hair, and then I prowl about our sanctuary like one of the lionesses in the tower. I comfort myself with plotting. We are not friendless. I am not without hope. My son, Thomas Gray, will be busy, I know, meeting in secret at hidden places those who can be convinced to rise for us. And there must be many in the country, in London too, who are beginning to doubt exactly what Duke Richard means by a protectorate. Margaret Stanley is clearly working for us. Her husband, Lord Thomas Stanley, warned Hastings. My sister-in-law, Duchess Margaret of York, will be working for us in Burgundy. Even the French should take an interest in my danger, if only to cause trouble for Richard. There is a safe house in Flanders, where a well-paid family is greeting a little boy and teaching him to disappear into the crowd of Tournai. The Duke may have the upper hand now, but there are as many who will hate him as hated us Riverses, and many more will be thinking fondly of me now I am in danger. Most of all, there will be the men who want to see Edward's son and not his brother on the throne. I hear the rush of hurried footsteps, and I turn to face new danger, as my daughter Cecily comes running down the crypt and throws open the door to my chamber. She is white with fright. "There is something at the door," she says. "Something horrible at the door." "What is at the door?" I ask. At once, of course, I think it is the headsman. "Something as tall as a man, but looking like death." I throw a scarf over my head and I go to the door and slide open the grill. Death himself seems to be waiting for me. He is in black gabardine with a tall hat on his head and a long white tube of a nose hiding all his face. It is a physician, with the long cone of his nose mask stuffed with herbs to protect him from the airs of the plague. He turns the glittery slits of his eyes on me, and I feel myself shiver. "There is none with plague in here," I say. "I am Dr. Lewis of Caerleon, the Lady Margaret Beaufort's doctor," he says, his voice echoing weirdly from the cone. "She says you are suffering from woman's maladies and would benefit from a physician." I open the door. "Come in. I am not well," I say. But as soon as the door is closed to the outside world, I challenge him. "I am perfectly well. Why are you here?" "The Lady Beaufort, Lady Stanley, I should say, is well too, God be praised for her. But she wanted to find a way to speak with you, and I am of her affinity and loyal to you, Your Grace." I nod. "Take off your mask." He takes the cone from his face and pushes back the hood from his head. He is a small, dark man with a smiling, trustworthy face. He bows low. "She wants to know if you have devised a plan to rescue the two princes from the tower. She wants you to know both she and her husband, the Lord Stanley, are yours to command. And she wants you to know that the Duke of Buckingham is filled with doubt as to where the Duke Richard's ambition is leading him. She thinks the young Duke is ready for turning. Buckingham has done everything to put the Duke where he sits now," I say. "Why would he change his mind on this day of their victory?" "Lady Margaret believes that the Duke of Buckingham could be persuaded," he says, leaning forward to speak only into my ear. "She thinks he is starting to have doubts as to his leader. She thinks he would be interested in other, greater rewards than those the Duke Richard can offer him. And he is a young man, not yet 30 years old, easily swayed. He is afraid that the Duke plans to take the throne for himself. He is afraid for the safety of your sons. You are his sister-in-law, these are his nephews too. He is concerned for the future of the princess, his little kinsman. Lady Margaret bids me say to you that she thinks that the servants in the tower can be bribed, and she wants to know how she can serve you, in what plans you have to restore the princes Edward and Richard to freedom." "It is not Richard," I start to say, when, like a ghost from the door to the river, Elizabeth comes up the steps the hem of her gown sodden. "Elizabeth, what on earth are you doing?" "I went down to sit by the river," she says. Her face is strange and pale. "It was so quiet and beautiful at first this morning, and then it became more and more busy. I wondered why the river was so busy. It was almost as if the river would tell me herself." She turns to regard the doctor. "Who is this?" "He is a messenger from Lady Margaret Stanley," I say. I am looking at her wet gown, which drags behind her like a tail. "How did you get so wet?" "From the barges that went by," she says. Her face is pale and hostile. "All the barges that went down the river to Baynard's castle, where Duke Richard is holding a great court. The wash from their passing was so great that it came in over the steps. What is happening there today? Half of London is on a barge going to the Duke's house, but it is supposed to be the day of my brother's coronation." Dr. Lewis looks awkward. "I was about to tell your royal mother," he says hesitantly. "The river itself is a witness," my daughter says rudely. "It washed over my feet as if to tell me. Anyone could guess." "Guess what?" I demand of them both. "The Parliament has met and declared that Duke Richard is the rightful king," he says quietly, though his words echo in the vaulted stone hall as if he were shouting a proclamation. "They ruled that your marriage with the king was held without the knowledge of the rightful lords and achieved by witchcraft by your mother and yourself, and that the king was married already to another lady." "So you have been a whore for years, and we are bastards," Elizabeth finishes coolly. "We are defeated and shamed. It is over, all over. Can we take Edward and Richard and go now?" "What are you saying?" I ask of her. I am as bewildered by this daughter of mine with her gown like a wet tail, like a mermaid come in from the river, as I am at the news that Richard has claimed the throne and we are cast down. "What are you saying? What were you thinking as you sat by the river? Elizabeth, you are so strange today. Why are you like this now?" "Because I think we are cursed," she flings out at me. "I think we are cursed. The river whispered a curse to me, and I blame you and my father for bringing us into this world and putting us here in the grip of ambition, and yet not holding strongly enough to your power to make it right for us." I snatch at her cold hands tightly, and I hold her as if I would keep her from swimming away. "You're not cursed, daughter. You are the finest and rarest of all my children, the most beautiful, the most beloved. You know that. What curse could stick to you?" The gaze she turns on me is darkened with horror, as if she has seen her death. "You will never surrender. You will never let us be. Your ambition will be the death of my brothers, and when they are dead, you will put me on the throne. You would rather have the throne than your sons, and when they are both dead, you will put me on my dead brother's throne. You love the crown more than your children." I shake my head to deny the power of her words. "This is my little girl. This is my easy, simple child. This is my pet, my Elizabeth. She is the very bone of my bone. She has never had a thought that I did not put in her head." "You cannot know such a thing. It's not true. You cannot know. The river cannot tell you such a thing, and you cannot hear it, and it's not true." "I will take my own brother's throne," she says, as if she cannot hear me. "And you will be glad of it, for your ambition is your curse, so the river says." I glance at the doctor and wonder if she has a fever. "Elizabeth, the river cannot speak to you." "Of course it speaks to me, and of course I hear it," she exclaims in impatience. There is no curse. She wheels around and glides across the room, her gown leaving a damp stain like a trail, and throws open the window. Dr. Lewis and I follow her, fearful for a moment that she has run mad and means to jump out. But at once, I am halted by a high, sweet keening from the river, a longing sound, a sound of mourning, a note so anguished that I put my hands over my ears to block it out and look to the doctor for an explanation. He shakes his head in bewilderment, for he hears nothing but the cheerful noise of the passing barges as they go down for the king's coronation, trumpets blaring and drums pounding. But he can see the tears in Elizabeth's eyes, and sees me shrink from the open windows, blocking my ears from the haunting sounds. "That's not for you," I say. I am choking on my grief. "Ah, Elizabeth, my love, that's not for you. That's Melusina's song, the song that we hear for a death in our house. That's not a warning song for you. This will be for my son, Richard Grey. I can hear it. It's for my son, and for my brother Anthony. My brother Anthony, whom I swore I would keep safe." The doctor is pale with fear. "I can hear nothing," he says. "Just the noise of the people calling for the new king." Elizabeth is at my side, her grey eyes as dark as a storm on a wave at sea. "Your brother? What do you mean?" "My brother and my son are dead at the hands of Richard, Duke of Gloucester, just as my brother John and my father were dead at the hands of George, Duke of Clarence," I predict. "The sons of York are murdering beasts, and Richard is no better than George. They have cost me the best men of my family, and broken my heart. I can hear it. I can hear this. This is what the river is singing. The river is singing a lament for my son and for my brother." She steps closer. She is my tender girl again, her wild fury blown away. She puts her hand on my shoulder. "Mother, do you think he will stop here?" I burst out frantically. "He has my boy. He has my royal son. If he dares to take Anthony from me, if he could bear to take Richard Grey from me, do you think he will stop at taking Edward too? A brother and a son he has robbed from me this day. I will never forgive him. I will never forget this. He is a dead man to me. I will see him wither. I will see his sword arm fail him. I will see him turn around looking for his friends like a lost child on the battlefield. I will see him fall." "Mother, be still," she whispers. "Be still and listen to the river." It is the only word that can calm me. I run down the length of the room and throw open all the windows, and the warm summer air breathes into the cold darkness of the crypt. The water babbles low against the banks. There is a stink of low tide and mud, but the river flows on, as if to remind me that life goes on, as if to say that Anthony has gone, my boy Richard Grey has gone, and my boy the little Prince Richard has gone downstream to strangers on a little boat. But we might still flow deep once more. There is music coming from some of the passing barges, noblemen making merry at the accession of Duke Richard. I cannot understand how they cannot hear the singing of the river, how they do not know that a light has gone out of this world with the death of my brother Anthony and my boy. My boy. "He would not want you to grieve," she says quietly. "Uncle Anthony loved you so much. He would not want you to grieve." I put my hand on hers. "He would want me to live. and to bring you children through this danger to life, I say. We will hide in sanctuary for now. But I swear we will come out again to our true place. You can call this the curse of ambition if you like, but without it, I would not fight. And I will fight. You will see me fight, and you will see me win. If we have to set sail to Flanders, we will do that. If we have to snap like cornered dogs, we will do that. If we have to hide like peasants in Tournai and live on eels from the River Scheldt, we will do that. But Richard will not destroy us. No man of this earth can destroy us. We will rise up. We are the children of the goddess Melusina. We may have to ebb, but surely we will flow again. And Richard will learn this. He has caught us now at a low and dry place, but by God, he will see us in flood. I speak very bravely, but once I am silent, I slide into grief for my grey son, and for my brother, my dearest brother Anthony. I think of Richard Grey as a little boy once more, sitting so high on the king's horse, holding my hand at the side of the road as we waited for the king to come by. He was my boy. He was my beautiful boy. And his father died in battle against one York brother, and now he is dead at the hands of another. I remember my mother mourning her son, and saying that when you have got a child through babyhood, you think you are safe. But a woman is not safe. Not in this world. Not in this world where brother fights against brother, and no one can ever put their sword aside or trust in the law. I think of him as a baby in the cradle, as a toddler, when he learnt to walk holding on to my fingers, up and down the gallery at Grafton, till my back ached from stooping. And then I think of him as the young man he was, a good man in the making. And Anthony, my brother, has been my dearest and most trusted friend and adviser since we were children together. Edward was right to call him the greatest poet and the finest knight at court. Anthony, who wanted to go on pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and who would have gone had I not stopped him. Richard dined with the two of them at Stony Stratford when they met on the road to London, and talked pleasantly of the England that we would all build together, Rivers's and Plantagenet's, of the shared heir, my boy, whom we would put on the throne. Anthony was no fool, but he trusted Richard. Why should he not? They were kinsmen. They had been side by side in battle, brothers in arms. They had gone into exile together, and returned to England in triumph. They were both uncles and guardians to my precious son. In the morning, when Anthony came downstairs to breakfast in his inn, he found the doors barred and his men ordered away. He found Richard and Henry Stafford, the Duke of Buckingham, armed for battle, their men standing stone-faced in the yard. And they took him away, with my boy Richard Grey and Sir Thomas Vaughan, accused of treason, though they all three were faithful servants of my boy, the new king. Anthony, in prison, awaiting his death in the morning, listens at the window for a moment, in case there is such a thing as the strong, sweet song of Melusina, expecting to hear nothing, and then smiles when he hears a bell-like ringing. He shakes his head to clear the noise from his ears, but it stays, an unearthly voice that makes him irreverently chuckle. He never believed the legend of the girl who was half fish and half woman, the ancestor of his house, but now he finds he is comforted to hear her singing for his death. He stays at the window and leans his forehead against the cool stone. To hear her voice, high and clear, around the battlements of Pontefract Castle, proves at last that his mother's gifts and his sister's gifts and her daughter's gifts are real, as they always claimed, as he only half believed. He wishes he could tell his sister that he knows this now. They may need these gifts. Their gifts may be enough to save them, perhaps to save all the family who named themselves rivers to honor the water goddess who was the founder of their family. Perhaps even to save their two Plantagenet boys. If Melusina can sing for him, an unbeliever, then perhaps she can guide those who listen for her warnings. He smiles because the high, clear song gives him hope that Melusina will watch over his sisters and her boys, especially the boy who was in his care, the boy he loves, Edward, the new King of England. And he smiles because her voice is that of his mother. He spends the night not in praying, nor in weeping, but in writing. In his last hours, he is not an adventurer, nor a knight, nor even a brother or an uncle, but a poet. They bring his writings to me, and I see that at the end, at the very moment he was facing his death, and the death of all his hopes, he knew that it was all vanity. Ambition, power, even the throne itself that has cost our family so dear. At the end he knew it was all meaningless. And he did not die in bitterness at this knowledge, but smiling at the folly of man, at his own folly. He writes, "Somewhat musing and more mourning in remembering the unsteadfastness, this world being of such wheeling, me contrarying, what may I guess? With displeasure to my grievance and no surance of remedy. Lo, in this trance, now in substance, such is my dance, willing to die. Methinks truly bounden am I, and that greatly, to be content, seeing plainly fortune doth wry all contrary from mine intent." This is the last thing he does at dawn. And then they take him out and behead him, on the orders of Richard, Duke of Gloucester, the new Lord Protector of England, who is now responsible for my safety, the safety of all my children, and especially the safety and future of my son, Prince Edward, the rightful King of England. I read Anthony's poem later, and I think that I particularly like "Fortune doth wry all contrary from mine intent." Fortune has gone against all us Riverses this season. He was right in that. And I shall have to find a way to live without him. Something has changed between my daughter Elizabeth and me. My girl, my child, my first baby, has suddenly grown up, grown away. The child who believed that I knew everything, that I commanded everything, is now a young woman who has lost her father and doubts her mother. She thinks I am wrong to keep us in sanctuary. She blames me for the death of her uncle Anthony. She accuses me, though never saying a word, of failing to rescue her brother Edward, of sending her little brother Richard out unprotected into the grey silence of the evening river. She doubts that I have secured a safe hiding place for Richard, and that our plan at the Changeling Page will work. She knows that if I sent a false prince to keep Edward company, it is because I doubt my ability to get Edward home safe. She has no hopes of the uprising that my grey son Thomas is organizing. She fears that we will never be rescued. Ever since the morning when we heard the singing of the river, and then the afternoon when they brought us the news of Anthony and Richard Grey's death, she has no faith in my judgment. She has not repeated her belief that we are cursed, but there is something about the darkness of her eyes and the pallor of her face that tells me she is hag-ridden. God knows I have not cursed her, and I know no one who would do such a thing to such a girl of gold and silver. But it is true. She looks as if someone has put a dark thumbprint down on her and marked her out for a hard destiny. Dr. Lewis comes again, and I ask him to look at her and tell me if she is well. She has almost stopped eating, and she is pale. She needs to be free, he says simply. I tell you as a physician what I hope to see soon as an ally. All your children, you yourself, Your Grace, cannot stay here. You need to be out in the good air, enjoying the summer. She is a delicate girl. She needs exercise and sunshine. She needs company. She is a young woman. She should be dancing and courting. She needs to plan her future, to dream of her betrothal, not to be cooped up here, fearing death. I have an invitation from the king. I make myself say the title, as if Richard could ever deserve it, as if the crown on his head and the oil on his breast could make him anything more than the traitor and the turncoat he is. The king is anxious that I take the girls to my house in the country this summer. He says the princes can be released to me there. And will you go? He is intent on my answer. He leans forward to hear. My boys must be released to me first. I have no guarantee of my safety or that of my girls unless my boys are returned to me, as he promised they would be. Take care, Your Grace. Take care. Lady Margaret fears he will play you false, he breathes. She says the Duke of Buckingham thinks that he will have your boys. He hesitates, as if he cannot bear to say the words. Done to death. She says that the Duke of Buckingham is so horrified by this that he will rescue your boys for you, restore your sons to you, if you will guarantee his safety and his prosperity when you are back in power. If you will promise him your friendship, your undying friendship, when you come to your own again. Lady Margaret says that she will bring him to make an alliance with you and yours. The three families, Stafford, Rivers, and the House of Lancaster, against the false king. I nod. I have been waiting for this. What does he want? I ask bluntly. His daughter, when he has one, to marry your son, the young King Edward, he says. He himself to be named as regent and Lord Protector till the young king is of age. He himself to have the kingdom of the north, just as Duke Richard had. If you will make him as great a duke as your husband made Duke Richard, he will betray his friend and rescue your sons. And what does she want? I ask, as if I cannot guess, as if I do not know that she has spent every day of the last 12 years, ever since her son was exiled, trying to bring him safely back to England. He is the only child she has ever conceived, the only heir to her family fortune, to her dead husband's title. Everything she achieves in her life will be nothing if she cannot get her son back to England to inherit. She wants an agreement that her son can take his title and inherit her lands, her brother-in-law Jasper restored to his lands in Wales. She wants them both free to return to England, and she wants to betroth her son, Henry Tudor, to your daughter Elizabeth, and to be named as heir after your boys, he says in a rush. I do not pause for a moment. I have only been waiting for the terms, and these are exactly what I expected. Not through foreseeing, but through the commonplace sense of what I would demand if I were in Lady Margaret's strong position. Married to the third greatest man in England, in alliance with the second, planning to betray the first. I agree, I say. Tell the Duke of Buckingham and tell Lady Margaret that I agree. And tell them my price. I have to have my sons restored to me at once. Next morning, my brother Lionel comes to me smiling. There is someone to see you at the Watergate, he says. A fisherman. Greet him quietly, my sister. Remember that discretion is a woman's greatest gift. I nod and hurry to the door. Lionel puts a hand on my arm. Less a bishop, more a brother. Don't shriek like a girl, he says bluntly, and lets me go. I slip through the door and go down the stone steps that lead to the stone corridor. It is shadowy, lit only by the daylight filtering through the iron gate that opens out to the river. A little wherry is bobbing at the doorway, a small fishing net piled in the stern. A man in a filthy cape and a pulled-down hat is waiting at the doorway, but nothing can disguise his height. Forewarned by Lionel, I don't cry out, and dissuaded by the stink of old fish, I don't run into his arms. I just say quietly, "Brother, my brother, I am glad with all my heart to see you." A flash of his dark eyes from under the heavy brim shows me my brother Richard Woodville's smiling face, villainously covered with a beard and a moustache. "Are you all right?" I ask, rather shocked at his appearance. "Never better," he says jauntily. "And you know about our brother Anthony?" I ask, "and my son Richard Gray?" He nods, suddenly grim. "I heard this morning. That's partly why I came today. I am sorry, Elizabeth. I am sorry for your loss." "You are Earl Rivers now," I say, "the third Earl Rivers. You are head of the family. We seem to be getting through heads of our family rather quickly. Do you please hold the title a little longer?" "I'll do what I can," he promises. "God knows I inherit the title of two good men. I hope to hold it longer, but I doubt I can do better. Anyway, we are close to an uprising. Listen to me." Richard feels himself secure with the crown on his head, and he is to go on progress to show himself to the kingdom. I have to stop myself spitting into the water. I wonder the horses have the brass neck even to walk. As soon as he is out of London, his guard with him, we will storm the tower and get Edward out. The Duke of Buckingham is with us, and I trust him. He has to travel with King Richard, and the king will force Stanley go with him too. He still doubts him. But Lady Margaret will stay in London and command the Stanley men and her own affinity to join us. Already she has her men placed in the tower. Will we have enough men? Near on 100. The new king has made Sir Robert Brackenbury the constable of the tower. Brackenbury would never hurt a boy in his care. He is a good man. I have put new servants in the royal rooms, men who will open the doors for me when I give them the word. And then? We get you and the girls safely away to Flanders. Your sons, Richard and Edward, can join you. He says, "Have you heard from the men who took Prince Richard yet? Is he safe in hiding?" "Not yet," I say fretfully. "I've been looking for a message every day. I should have heard that he is safe by now. I pray for him every hour. I should have heard by now." "A letter could have gone astray. It means nothing. If it had gone wrong, they would have sent you news for sure. And just think, you can collect Richard from his hiding place on your way to Margaret's court. Once you are with your boys and safe again, we raise our army. Buckingham will declare for us. Lord Stanley and his whole family is promised by his wife Margaret Beaufort. Half of Richard's other lords are ready to turn against him, according to the Duke of Buckingham. Lady Margaret's son Henry Tudor will raise arms and men in Brittany and invade Wales." "When?" I breathe. He glances behind him. The river is busy as ever with ships coming and going, little trading wherries weaving in and out of the bigger boats. "Duke Richard," he breaks off and grins at me. "Forgive me. King Richard is to leave London at the end of July on progress. We will rescue Edward at once, and give you and him long enough to get to safety, say 2 days, and then, while the king is out of touch, we will rise."
"And Edward, our brother?"
"Edward is recruiting men in Devon and Cornwall. Your son Thomas is working in Kent. Buckingham will bring out the men from Dorset and Hampshire. Stanley will bring out his affinity from the Midlands, and Margaret Beaufort and her son can raise Wales in the name of the Tudors. All the men of your husband's household are determined to save his sons." I nibble at my finger, thinking as my husband would have thought. Men, arms, money, and the spread of support around the south of England. It is enough if we can defeat Richard before he brings in his men from the north. He grins at me, the Rivers's reckless grin. It is enough, and we have everything to win and nothing to lose, he says. He has taken the crown from our boy. We have nothing to fear. The worst has already happened. The worst has already happened, I repeat, and the shiver that goes down my spine I attribute to the loss of Anthony, my brother, my dearest brother, and the death of my grey son. The worst has already happened. There can be nothing worse than our losses already. Richard puts his dirty hand on mine. Be ready to leave whenever I send the word, he says. I will tell you as soon as I have Prince Edward safe. I will. July, 1483. I am waiting at the window, dressed in my travelling cape, my chest of jewels at my hand, my girls with me, ready to leave. We are silent. We have been silently waiting for more than an hour. We are straining to hear something, anything, but there is only the slap of the river against the walls and the occasional burst of music or laughter from the streets. Elizabeth beside me is tight as a lute string, white with anxiety. Then there is a sudden crash of noise, and my brother Lionel comes running into the sanctuary and slams and bolts the door behind him. We failed, he says, gasping for breath. Our brothers are safe, your son too. They got away down the river, and Richard went to earth in the Minories, but we couldn't take the White Tower. Did you see my boy? I demanded. He shakes his head. They had the two boys in there. I heard them shouting orders. We were so close I could hear them shouting through the door to take the boys inward, to a more secure chamber. Dear God, sister, forgive me. I was the thickness of a door away from them, but we could not batter it down. I sit down as my knees give way beneath me, and I drop the box of jewels to the floor. Elizabeth is ashen. She turns and slowly starts to take the girls' capes off, one by one, folding them up, as if it is important that they are not creased. My son, I say, my son. We got in through the water gate, and then across the first lane before they even saw us. We were starting up the steps as someone sounded the alarm, and though we sprinted up the steps to the door of the White Tower, they slammed it shut. We were just seconds away from it. Thomas was firing at the locks, and we threw ourselves against it, but I heard the bolts slam from the inside, and then they came pouring out of the guard room. Richard and I turned to face them, and we fought, holding them off, while Thomas and the Stanley men tried to batter the door in, or even lift it from its hinges. But, you know, it is too strong. The Stanleys were there, as they promised. They were, and Buckingham's men. None in their livery, of course, but they all wore a white rose. It was strange to see the White Rose again, and strange to be fighting to enter a place that we own. I shouted to Edward to be of good cheer, that we would come for him, that we would not fail him. I don't know if he heard. I don't know. You're hurt, I say, suddenly noticing the cut on his forehead. He rubs it, as if his blood were dirt. It is nothing, Elizabeth. I would rather have died than come back without him. Don't speak of death, I say quietly. Pray God he is safe tonight and was not frightened by this. Pray God they just take him to a more secure room inside the tower and don't think to take him away. And it may only be for another month, he says to me. Richard said to remind you of that. Your friends are arming. King Richard is riding north with only his personal guard. Buckingham and Stanley are in his train. They will persuade him not to turn back. They will encourage him to go on to York. Jasper Tudor will bring an army from Brittany. Our next battle will come soon. When the usurper Richard is dead, we will have the keys to the tower in our hands. Elizabeth straightens up, her sister's cloak draped neatly over her arm. And do you trust all your new friends, mother? She asks coldly. All these new allies who have suddenly come to your side but don't succeed. All of them ready to risk their lives to restore Edward to his throne, when they all ate well and drank deep at Duke Richard's coronation just a few weeks ago. I hear that Lady Margaret carried the train of the new Queen Anne, just as she used to carry yours. The new queen kissed her on both cheeks. She was honored at the coronation. Now she calls out her men for us. Now she is our loyal ally. The Duke of Buckingham was the ward who hated you for marrying him to my Aunt Catherine, and he still hates you. Are these your true allies? Or are they loyal servants of the new king set out to entrap you? For they played both parts, and they are travelling with him now and feasting at Oxford. They weren't there in danger at the Tower, rescuing my brother. I look at her coldly in return. I cannot choose my allies, I say. To save my son, I would plot with the devil himself. She shows me the ghost of a sour smile. Perhaps you already have. August 1483. The summer grows very hot, and Lionel slips out of Sanctuary and out of London to join our brothers and our allies in the rebellion that is to defeat Richard. Without him, I feel very much alone. Elizabeth is quiet and distant, and I have nobody to share my fears. Downriver, my son remains a prisoner in the Tower, and Gemma tells us that nobody sees him or the little changeling playing in the Tower gardens anymore. They had been practicing archery on the green, but nobody sees them at the Butts now. Since our rescue attempt, their guardians have kept them close inside, and I start to fear the danger of plague in the heat of the city and think of them in those small, dark rooms. At the end of August, there is a shout from a boatman on the river, and I swing open the window wide and look out. Sometimes they bring me gifts, often just a creel of fish, but this man has a ball in his hand. "Can you catch your grace?" he asks, seeing me at the window. I smile. "Yes, I can," I say. "Then catch this," he says, and tosses a white ball up to me. It comes soaring through the window over my head, and I reach up and catch it double-handed, and laugh for a moment at the fun of playing again. Then I see it is a ball wrapped in white paper, and I go back to the window, but the man has gone. I unwrap it and smooth out the paper, and I put my hand to my heart and then to my mouth to silence my cry, as I recognize the childish round hand of my little boy Richard. "Dearest Lady Mother, greetings and blessings," he starts carefully. "I am not allowed to write often, nor to tell you exactly where I am, in case the letter is stolen, except to say that I arrived safely, and it is quite all right here. They are kind people, and I have learned how to row a boat already, and they say I am good and handy. In a little while I am to go away to school, for they cannot teach me all I need to know here. But I will come back for the summer and go fishing for eels, which are very nice when you get used to them, unless I can come home to you again. Give my love to my sisters, and my love and duty to my brother the king, and my honour and love to you. Signed, your son, Richard, Duke of York. Though now I am called Peter, and I remember to answer to Peter always. The woman here, who is kind to me, calls me her little Perkin, and I don't mind this." I read the words through tears. Then I mop my eyes and read them again. I smile at the thought of his being called Handy, and I have to take a breath to stop myself crying out at the thought of his being called Perkin. I want to weep at his being taken away from me, so young, such a small boy. And yet he is safe. I should be glad that he is safe. The only one of my children away from the danger of being of this family, in this country, in these wars, which will start again. The boy who now answers to Peter will go quietly to school, learn languages, music, and wait. If we win, He will come home as a prince of the blood.